back, WNST, Towson Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We're calm, we're local, and sort of making the rounds here as the weather heats up. We are melting down with some delicious vanilla bean ice cream here from our friends at Taharka, made in Baltimore. Sweet vanilla ice cream, flex, and vanilla beans in there, serving up social change and delivering this delicious Taharka ice cream to you. We appreciate their sponsorship of Baltimore Positive. Also, our friends at Fadley's downtown delivering those delicious Fadley's crab cakes. You want to be a hero for the 4th of July? Send some Fadley's crab cakes to them. You can ship them from anywhere in the world, one click away on their website. Also, pick them up down at Lexington Market, where we broadcasted for about a year and a half before COVID got a hold of us. And State Fair, the same story over in Catonsville. Once COVID is over, we're going to be moving into El Guapo and doing some Mexican broadcast over there with some delicious nachos, guacamole, and I can't wait to get my first margarita. We're going to have Evan Brown from State Fair and El Guapo on, as well as Damie Hahn from Fadley's this week here at Baltimore Positive. Don, I'm going to let you talk about Jeff Moeller and Moeller and Gary Realty before we welcome Marty Rosendale in here from Maryland Tech Council.
Well, I think I've said before on the show, it's been remarkable for me to watch Jeff and his colleagues, really, just the work they're doing during the pandemic. As a number of articles have pointed out lately, the real estate market has never been hotter. I joked with him last week, Nestor, there was a home, you probably saw it, that he listed and posted on Facebook. And as soon as I saw the video, I private texted him and I said, well, looking at that home, I don't think that's going to last a week. And he said, he wrote back and said, Dad, it's not going to last a day. And sure enough, you know, by the end of the day, there were three or four offers, all of them above the asking price. So now's the time. So if you're thinking about buying or selling, give Jeff a call, 410-746-1547. So, Nestor, I know you've run into our next guest, so why don't you sort of open us up here.
Well, I mean, we talk about things that advance what we're doing around here at Baltimore Positive, and we talk about this COVID-19 situation, and literally every organization everywhere in the world, literally taxed. We thought it'd be a good time to catch up with the Maryland Tech Council because of their work. We talk about things that are going to fix us, things that are going to get us better, and so obviously staying on the front end of all sorts of local businesses. Marty Rosendale is the CEO of the Maryland Tech Council, as well as a longtime partner in Newport LLC and Trusted Advisors, works with people like me, other CEOs, and trying to get businesses and startups getting going where they need to go. Marty, welcome in. You know, all these years, 261 mutual connections for you and I on LinkedIn. That's all. I would both say we're both Baltimore Positive around here, aren't we?
I would say so, Nestor. It's amazing how many connections we have in common. But thank you for inviting me to join you on Baltimore Positive, and I would say we're absolutely both Baltimore Positive.
Well, let's talk about the Maryland Tech Council. Like, let's say right around March 11th or 12th, right? Like a different world than where you are as we head into July and August, and who knows where this thing's going to end and where the election's going to go in November. But give me an overview of the Maryland Tech Council before March, and then sort of kicking it into overdrive for all the COVID stuff that's going on here in the last 5 months.
Sure. So as you know, the Maryland Tech Council represents all of the technology and life science companies throughout the state of Maryland. We currently have 455 members. Those members are doing everything from developing vaccines, cell and gene therapies, to providing cybersecurity for people around the world. So before March, we were focused on a number of things. We advocate with the legislature on behalf of our members. We work with our members to make sure that they can make the connections that they need to succeed. Fundamentally, our role as the Industry Trade Association is to help our members succeed. And we do that through, as I said, helping them make connections, collaborations, introducing them to potential investors, strategic partners. Anything that we can do to help them further their mission and succeed as companies in Maryland. Since March, so it's amazing, Nestor, what's happened in Maryland over the last few months. It's hard to imagine that in the middle of January was the first time that we actually knew what the gene sequence of the COVID-19 virus was. Because in just a few short months, our companies here in Maryland have pivoted and are working on vaccines. They're working on therapeutics. They've expanded the diagnostic capacity. It's just phenomenal what has gone on here, and none of it would have been possible if it weren't for the tremendous sense of collaboration that the companies in this region have. The companies came together early on. You know, we noticed that companies were pivoting rapidly to address the response to COVID-19. So we began pulling them together. We created what we call the COVID Coalition. The first call we had with this group, I believe, was in late March. We had 35 representatives from 25 companies that had already pivoted to be a part of the response to the virus. Today, there are over 40 companies in the region that are part of this coalition. In addition to the University System of Maryland has created a COVID-19 task force, and we've connected that task force with this coalition. We've been able to facilitate connections, collaboration, just, you know, support the amazing work that these companies have been accomplishing since this all began. And, you know, just the possibility of having a vaccine potentially by the end of this calendar year, you know, certainly by the spring, is unheard of. Just a few months ago, if you would have asked anybody in the industry if that were possible, they would have told you no way. But it's going to happen.
Well, Marty, you used the word pivot, right? And the one thing for me back in March and early April, when Don and I separated and, you know, put all the shows on the shelf and started to do, where are we going with the election? Where are we going with vaccines and all? The one thing about Maryland, and I remember Larry Hogan bringing in the mask and the PPE and the tests from South Korea and all that. I said, this is a really special place, Maryland, because of all the research that's done here. We cannot be a hotspot, right? I mean, we need to shut down. We need to keep the doctors and the researchers safe. Speak to that a little bit, because I don't know that the world thinks of Maryland as sort of this tech hotbed, but certainly over the last year and a half and everything Don and I have talked about with cyber, with from our first guest in Dutch Ruppersberger to, you know, everything that's going on with Weller and everything that's going on at Port Covington, for tech and for Maryland, where do we stand in the 50 states as far as state by state against other tech councils?
Well, you know, I've said this before, the world depends on what happens in Maryland. Here in Maryland, in addition to the amazing companies and industry that we have, we also have the FDA. We have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the largest healthcare payer in the world. We have the National Institutes of Health, which do amazing research that supports health around the world. So the world truly depends on things that happen in Maryland. And to your point, you know, we have to stay healthy. We have to make sure that we can continue this work. I think our governor and our population in general has done an amazing job keeping the state healthy so that we can do this this important work. But you know, it boils down to the mission of the life sciences and biotech industry in general. And this is an industry that is very mission driven, and the ability to pivot, as I said, you know, nobody was testing for COVID-19 before January. Nobody was working on a vaccine. Nobody was working on a therapy, and the ability to start that work just because it was necessary is phenomenal. Excuse me, phenomenal.
Well, Marty, you alluded to it, and I think it's really what people are focused on right now, and that is a timeline for a vaccine. And I don't mean just when it's getting tested. Like you said, we're going at warp speed. But I want you also to help educate our listeners that doesn't mean that come New Year's Day, we're all going to be in line getting vaccinated. Give our listeners a sense of how complex this is.
Sure. So you know, again, stepping back to we didn't understand the molecular makeup of this virus until the middle of January. So the first thing that had to happen was the researchers had to come together, and they had to understand exactly what this virus was, what does it look like, what are the proteins, what is the DNA or in this case RNA of this virus look like. Once they had that information, they had to look at it and and determine, well, what can we do? How do we build a vaccine? What technologies do we use to build a vaccine? And they had to go into the lab, and they actually had to put these pieces together. They had to identify the proteins. They had to identify the nucleic acids, the molecular makeup. Then they had to manufacture these pieces and put them together so that they could produce a vaccine. Then once they had that, they had to create a formula for the vaccine and put it into something that could be used in human trials. Once they've got that component ready, so now they actually have a vaccine, they have something that they can inject, they can test. The first step is to do animal studies to make sure it's safe, because you don't want to inject anything in humans that you know to be unsafe. So they had to go through a series of animal studies, laboratory studies and animal studies, to determine that it's safe. Now, today, we're in human studies. So we've determined that these initial vaccines are safe enough to conduct human studies. We're in human studies. And we've got companies like AstraZeneca, GlaxoSmithKline, Altimmune, Scenaria, Emergent BioSolutions, Novavax, all in this region working on producing these vaccines. So now once they get through the human studies, and we can determine not only that they're safe to use, now we can also determine whether or not they produce any immunity. Once we've got all of that work behind us, now we can start looking at the complexity of manufacturing, because we have to be able to manufacture hundreds of millions of doses of these vaccines in order for it to be effective. So there's a huge manufacturing logistical component that needs to be addressed. And we have those resources here in Maryland as well, with the Emergent BioSolutions and their manufacturing facilities in Baltimore and other contract manufacturers that we have. So those organizations, even though these vaccines aren't ready for commercialization, aren't ready for manufacturing, those organizations are already gearing up the manufacturing capacity at risk, knowing that it's coming, so that they're ready to receive these vaccines and start producing them at commercial scale as quickly as possible. So there's just an amazing number of steps, and I didn't even mention the regulatory piece of this. The cooperation with the FDA. The FDA has had to make adjustments in the way they look at these things as well, so that they can move at the same pace and at the same time keep these products safe for the public to use. So just the number of pieces that have had to come together, the number of organizations that have had to collaborate on this is phenomenal.
Marty, we don't get a whole lot of microbiologists on the program here, people from the engineering space. We usually get politicians and stuff, but Marty Rosendale is your CEO of the Maryland Tech Council and microbiologist and engineer. You put on your microbiology hat here, and or dare I say the nerd hat, and say, all right, you're reading the paper, you're reading the internet, January. By the way, I was in Asia in December, so my wife and I think we contracted and fought this thing off successfully back in January. We were both pretty sick. But when you hear about a pandemic and you hear about Ebola and you're going back to when you were younger, HIV, these things, these pandemic things that happen, when you think America, microbiology, epidemiology, all the money we have, all the resources we have, this thing's coming from China. Could you have imagined that we would be on the 4th of July shut down still pretty much as a country?
You know, I have to admit, when it first hit, I wasn't surprised. There are many people that have backgrounds similar to my own that knew that eventually this was coming, something like this was going to happen. But I didn't expect it to last quite as long as it has.
Well, the smartest people in the world weren't worried about a bomb. They were worried about a pandemic, right? Like, I mean, if over the last 15 years, if you did TED Talks, pandemic was really at the top of scourge thing beyond mosquitoes that might kill us all, literally, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So this isn't a shock. This was not a shocker to them. Might be a shocker to the President of the United States and to other people who've not researched this, but for microbiologists, you guys have been on to this for a while.
Right. No, this wasn't a surprise for anybody who's been in this space. It was not a surprise.
So what do you do about it then? There really was a playbook for this for smart people, right?
Yeah, and I think to a great extent that playbook worked. I mean, to be able to consolidate what normally would take 5 or more years to develop a therapy or a vaccine, to be able to push that down to 18 months. I would say that playbook is working.
Well, Marty, on that timeline again, and again, I don't want to put you on a spot. You're not speaking for every company and all the microbiologists and the immunologists in the world. But when would you suspect that? Let's really break it down to the, you know, most people and most seniors in Baltimore County get their flu shots by going to the local senior center, usually somewhere from September to the middle of October of every year. When would you expect a vaccine for COVID-19 to be widely available like that, where a senior will call their local senior center, make an appointment, go over, and get this shot the same day they get their flu shot?
You know, that's really a tough one. Everybody would like to know the answer to that question. I was listening to a report just this morning, and the CDC was talking about how they're working through their distribution plan now. So even the CDC can't answer that question for you right now. Basically, what you're asking is, when is it going to be mainstream? When is it going to be available to anyone and everyone that requests it? You know, initially, it has to be directed to high risk in high need areas. Our healthcare workers, the heroes that are out there that are dealing with this every day, they've got to get access to it first before anybody else. And there are a tremendous number of those heroes. You know, the clerks that work in our grocery stores should have access to it, because you know they're out there putting themselves out there with respect to this virus. Is it going to be mainstream to anybody that requests it? That's really a tough call.
Let's flip it though, Marty, just to help people. Let's flip it in this way though. I think, you correct me if I'm wrong, but if anyone thinks that and I love your term mainstream, if anyone thinks that a vaccination is going to be mainstream in the spring of 2021, that's probably way too optimistic, correct?
I would say that's very optimistic. I think it's reasonable to expect that the vaccine will be available, but to have it mainstream at that point, I think is too optimistic.
Yeah, and we can't get back to normal without that. So these insights are invaluable. While we're talking all about this one, and I'm thinking of the impact in Maryland, give us a sense of the importance of the whole tech industry to the economic health of the state of Maryland. Can you sort of give us the Four Dummies tutorial on that? Because it has to be, I think it has to be significant.
Well, it is significant. Now, off the top of my head, I don't know how much of the total state economics that the tech industry and the life science industries make up, because they're both very big. We have about 600 or 700 biotechnology companies, 2,700 life science organizations, if you include all the academic and federal laboratories as well. And then on the technology and cybersecurity side of the world, you know, because of the importance of cybersecurity here in Maryland, we have something between 2,000 and 3,000technology and cybersecurity companies as well. So both industries are huge and make up a significant part of the economy in the state.
I want to make sure I ask you about 5G before we get out of here, because we talk about COVID, and I'm sure, you know, as this thing unfolds, there's going to be all sorts of stories and from all of these local businesses. But 5G, my wife's a Verizon engineer, and, you know, 3G, 4G, here we go with 5G. Tell me about jobs in the future and 5G and what this is going to represent, specifically here in Maryland for your constituency.
Well, so 5G is critical to a lot of the technology that's in development now. So things like autonomous vehicles, things that require very, very rapid data communication, 5G is critical to those types of technologies. And so it's important that we deploy 5G as rapidly as possible, but it's also an opportunity to, you know, to correct the disparity between the access to the internet and Wi-Fi throughout the state or throughout the country. As we deploy 5G, if we deploy it equitably and evenly throughout the state, then we can clear up some of that disparity as well. So it's an opportunity to get everybody access to the internet and to the information that they need access to, but it's also a technology that's critical to the future of the tech industry, because as we develop more of these technologies, as we rely more heavily on things like what they call edge computing, which is, you know, devices and technologies that require rapid data communications, then 5G is critical to that. So our position with respect to 5G is that it gets deployed as rapidly as possible and as equitably as possible.
Well, we've talked so much about education, you know, sort of deserts where people can't get Wi-Fi, and we've talked to so many leaders, especially at universities, saying, you know, we sent kids home in the middle of semester, they don't have Wi-Fi, tablets, all of that, the access to all of that. Do you see 5G as something 3 years, 5 years, 7 years from now being some sort of universal thing that everyone would have here?
You know, I hope so. I hope that if we take an approach, and I know that the companies that are deploying the technology for 5G are looking at it this way as well, but if we take an approach that the deployment of 5G can be used as a solution to that inequitable distribution of internet access, then I, you know, this is Marty Rosendale talking, I'm not talking for the Tech Council, but I believe and hope that it's an opportunity to fix that disparity.
Well, we've really enjoyed the visit here, and you know,
hey Nestor, can I just one?
Yeah, sure. Throw it in
before we let Marty run. Just on me, I'm sitting here. I'm basically, as Nestor knows, Marty, I can almost hit a golf ball from my house to UMBC, and it makes me think they're so involved in tech. What's the role of the Maryland Tech Council and higher ed in the state? Because higher ed seems to be such a resource in the state of Maryland. How do you all work with higher ed?
So we work with higher ed in a lot of ways. You know, workforce is a big issue. Workforce has been a big issue ever since, before the pandemic, when unemployment was so low, workforce was a huge issue. But a lot of what we do is we bring together members of our industry community to help advise the academic institutions, the higher education institutions, with respect to what does the industry need? What is the industry looking for with respect to workforce? What do they need today, and what do they envision they're going to need tomorrow? Because you know, especially the higher education universities, you know, they're working with students that are going to graduate in 4 to 8 years. And so they need to be looking at that future to assess what are these students going to need when they get out of college. And so we work with them by providing the industry perspective and that information and knowledge to help them inform their curriculum as they go forward. But we also work with them, for instance, you know, with coming back to the COVID pandemic, the University System of Maryland, when they formed their task force, got an idea that we ought to have a pandemic preparedness institute in the state, and industry needs to be a part of that. So we're working with those universities and industry to look at how do we form a pandemic preparedness institute so that when this happens again, how do we respond faster? How do we take these learnings that we're learning right now and apply them so that when this happens again, we can respond faster, more effectively, more efficiently. And so there's a number of ways that we work with those institutions of higher education.
Well, they are the future,
I like
right?
it when we have people on that are smarter than we are.
Oh, that's most people in my case. But an engineer turned microbiologist and an industry leader at the Maryland Technology Council. He's the CEO there, as well as a partner at Newport LLC, and helping businesses get started and stay afloat and making them better. We really appreciate the time, Marty. I hope one day we run into each other at a breakfast or a luncheon or a dinner or an event somewhere around town, as we've been known to do. And I hope you get to bring the whole Tech Council together into one room, closer than 6 feet apart, sometime soon too.
Well, that day is coming, Nestor. We'll get there, and we will run into each other. I'm sure of it.
I hope so. Marty Rosendale, CEO of the Maryland Tech Council, joining us here as we've expanded our conversation as the weather is heated up around here. Still want to give plenty of love to all of our sponsors. You can still ship those crab cakes from Fadley's anywhere in the world. You can still get over to State Fair and get chicken and waffles and a shrimp and grits. Get yourself a delicious salad and a soup and a sandwich for lunch. I'm taking my wife over for breakfast and a Bloody Mary this weekend for the 4th of July. I'll be eating some Taharka ice cream. The second I get reloaded, I'm down to like two or three flavors. I got a lot of empty boxes here on the set. The pistachio was the latest one to go. So make sure you're ordering your ice cream. Get yourself a little delivery. Lord knows I need a delivery. Taharka Brothers, local ice cream made right here in Baltimore. Also, our friends at Moeller & Gary Realty still selling those homes into the summer, listing them, stocking them, and selling them quicker than anybody. You can find out all that information from Jeff Moeller and our friends at Moeller & Gary Realty. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio, together at WNST.net, AM 1570. We are calm, local, and Baltimore positive.